For this session, we have Michael P. Walton, who will be presenting paper Joseph Smith and Science, the Methodist Connection. Michael got his BA, magna cum laude, and his MA at the University of Utah in history, and his PhD in history at the University of Chicago. He tells me when he's sober, he has been responsible for the writing of many publications, and we'll look forward to hearing from him. After he talks, we'll have Marvin Hill, professor of history, who also received his PhD at the University of Chicago, will comment on his paper.
Before I begin, I feel compelled to mention that there are certain people who have indicated there is such a thing as a school of history, the Chicago School of History, which is somehow a pernicious force in the world of Mormonism, and I'm sure that Marvin and I will be able to prove that there's not sufficient unanimity among Chicago graduates to justify the belief that we comprise a school, or even a sect of history, for that matter. My paper has a sort of subtitle, Joseph Smith and Science, the Methodist Connection, a case study in Mormonism as a response to 19th century American revivalism. And I want us to think of it as a case study. It isn't a finished product, and indeed, I'm making some suggestions, and I hope suggestions which other people will follow in their research, because my background is in the history of science. I do Renaissance history of science, and so a foray into American history is heady stuff for someone who reads dirty books written in Italy. Joseph Smith was a religious genius and not a scientist. Scientific ideas were never central to his theology or essential to his claim of having restored the primitive church. Some scientific ideas and a general view of science, known as natural theology, however, were inculcated into Mormonism. Though these ideas were not primary in Joseph Smith's religious outlook, they did influence the texture of his thought and became seeds for his successors who elaborated and polished the restored gospel. But they will suggest that the scientific ideas which Joseph Smith included in his religious synthesis, like many of his theological concepts, were taken from the religio-intellectual ferment of 19th century revivalist America. Because of needs, my case is based on comparison and inference. I do not hope to, quote, prove or settle any issue. My desire is rather to stimulate thought and further research by noting plausible connections between Joseph Smith's ideas and his religious environment. The Book of Mormon, as the earliest product of Joseph Smith's genius, is a logical place to begin a discussion of his use of natural theology. In its pages, the prophet Alma declares, quote, all things denote there is a God, yea, even the earth, and all things that is, sic, upon the face of it, yea, its motion, yea, and also the planets. Not only Alma speaks of the heavens and the earth, but also Nephi, who stated, quote, For sure it is the earth that moveth, and not the sun. Alma's belief that nature reveals God is a reflection of the argument from design. This argument is found in the Psalms and was invoked from ancient times into the present. It was the theological cornerstone of natural theology when it developed in the 17th century after Newton's system of the world came to be the dominant intellectual force in Western Europe. Nephi's explicit acceptance of the heliocentric system of astronomy, however, runs counter to both the geocentrism of the Hebrew Bible and the efforts of post-Copernican theologians to rationalize that biblical tradition with scientific theory. Such anachronism is a clue to Joseph Smith's knowledge of science and theology, which can aid us in understanding how his intellectual development is reflected in the Book of Mormon. While Book of Mormon scholarship has often been divided between the faith promoters and the faith destroyers, I will approach it from a secular scholarly tradition, which to some is coterminous with faith destroyers. Like Christer Stendahl, I find it useful to approach the Book of Mormon as a 19th century pseudepigraph. Now, as we all know, pseudepigraph means a false attribution of a work. You know, we have things like the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs in the intertestamental period. Obviously, it was not written by the 12 Patriarchs. But, I mean, I don't mean to use it in such a simple way. To me, this means a literary production of the 19th century which uses the forms of an ancient scripture to supply believers with answers to religious questions not found in genuine ancient scriptures. When viewed from this theological perspective, the Book of Mormon text reveals its author, Joseph Smith, responding to the controversies of his day. There's an absolutely marvelous quote in Marvin Hill's doctoral thesis, which is reproduced by his sister in Joseph Smith, the First Mormon. It quotes Alexander Campbell when he says that Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon reproduced basically every religious controversy and idea and came down on one side or the other of them. And this is certainly a very insightful view of the Book of Mormon from a contemporary. Before turning to the narrow issue of science in the Book of Mormon, I would like to illustrate the application of the pseudepigraph theory to the text by concentrating on reflections of the Methodist camp meeting in two passages. The camp meeting began in the Second Great Awakening at the turn of the 19th century as an ecumenical revival meeting. By the 1820s, however, it had become the exclusive property of the Methodists. In over 600 such gatherings a year, Methodist preachers hoped to bring religion to unchurched America. The camp meeting was one of the most significant social institutions on the frontier. People came from miles to help clear the land, erect the raised speaker's stand, and set up their family tents around the compound. For days, various preachers would deliver sermons on man's sinfulness and the need for atonement. Many would be stricken with their sense of sin and collapse in what was known as the falling exercise. They had people who would just go and pick them up and move them to a tent where they would put all of these unconscious people. At the end of the encampment, those who had been converted were enrolled in the Methodist record so that they could be visited by circuit preachers. Those who were not able to feel a manifestation of the divine were exhorted to, quote, go to the grove and seek God. Joseph Smith, by his own admission, was attracted to the personalized ecstatic religion of the Methodists. Their admonition to, quote, go to the grove for a personal experience with God may well explain why Joseph Smith recounted his first vision to a Methodist minister. It may also explain his bewilderment at the minister's rebuke. How could one who excited people to seek God recoil from one of the faithful who had succeeded? The prominence of the Methodist camp meeting on the frontier and Joseph Smith's personal interest in Methodism seemed to be reflected in detail in the Book of Mormon story known as King Benjamin's Discourse, which in the first edition is Mosiah chapters 1 to 4. This unit of the text parallels the structure of a camp meeting. Benjamin erects a speaker's tower. The people set up their tents round about. The sermon, like those of the camp preachers, dealt with sin and the hope of redemption. At the high point of Benjamin's discourse on sin and God's wrath, he saw, quote, the multitude, and behold, they had fell sick to the earth, for fear of the Lord had come upon them. After the falling exercise, the people were told of Jesus and the hope of redemption. When the sermon was completed, Benjamin had the names of those who believed enrolled. An interesting feature of the camp meeting, and indeed of most revivalist activities, this includes virtually every stump preacher that went through the countryside, was the confrontation between different ministers. Presbyterians and Baptists would often debate with each other and with the Methodists. And there are many accounts of the camp meetings where some Baptist will come up and chide the various preachers, and you get some interesting theological discussions going on there. These discussions resulted in a heightened awareness of the theological differences between the various faiths. One question which often came up was that of infant baptism. The question of baptism of children was, of course, a non-issue to pre- and post-exilic Israelites, because immersion was a means of removing ritual impurity rather than, quote, for the remission of sins. In the Book of Mormon, however, the baptism of infants was a burning issue. In the best pseudepigraphal tradition, the Book of Mormon resolved the problem in an authoritative way in favor of the Baptists. Mormon states in Moroni 8 that children are the partakers of salvation, and those who would baptize them, quote, shall perish except they repent. The frontier milieu reflected in the Book of Mormon contained not only religio-social events like the camp meeting and theological disputes, but also definite ideas about religion and nature. Unlike the question of baptism, clerics in general agreed with the proposition that a study of nature revealed something of its creator. This theological view had been a commonplace since the 17th century. The regularity and mathematical elegance of Newton's system of the world seemed to reinforce the argument from design. This greatly stimulated men of religion to develop a unified view of theology and science. The classical statement of this, quote, natural theology was made at the end of the 17th century by the noted naturalist John Ray in his work, The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of the Creation. The Boyle Lectures, which were lectures established in honor of Robert Boyle, were dedicated to this precise subject and continued down to through the middle of the 19th century. Virtually all trained and untrained clerics in England and America adhered to the position articulated by Ray until Darwin's studies attacked the fundamental assumptions of natural theology. And for those of you interested in the subject, that is indeed the crisis that Darwin brought about in biology, showing that there was an incommensurateness between science and religion, and that could not be resolved in any apparent way. And we still live with this in all of these silly conferences we have about creation science, etc. Assuming the universality of natural theology and the popularity of the idea of plurality of worlds, Fawn Brodie suggested that Joseph Smith derived his astronomical ideas, especially his belief in the plurality of worlds, from Thomas Dick's well-known text, The Philosophy of a Future State, which was published in 1828. Brodie's attempt to make a specific attribution of a source to Joseph Smith's ideas failed to take into account that it cannot be demonstrated that he read such a sophisticated work as Dick's before the middle of the 1830s. Given that natural theology was a commonplace and that many ministers dabbled in astronomy and speculated on the possibility of plural worlds, it is perhaps not necessary to follow Brodie and identify a specific source of Joseph Smith's rudimentary knowledge of astronomy. His general intellectual milieu may provide an adequate explanation. Now, Robert Paul, who's a historian of science at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, wrote a very long paper on Joseph Smith and plurality of worlds, which is not published, in which he goes into many reasons why Dick is probably not a source for Joseph Smith's thought at the early stages. But all of the evidence which he adduces tends to show that everybody and their pet pig was aware of these ideas. And we shouldn't become blinded by, you know, Brodie's groping for these kinds of things. She didn't really do a lot of research in this area. And often her research was very, very, very detailed, but it doesn't ever show much in some of her work. Because she has more of a literary interest in history than a technical interest. During Joseph Smith's youth, Yale was a center for ministerial training. The education there available was influenced by Timothy Dwight, a former president of the college. Dwight was well-versed in astronomy and a very passionate proponent of the idea of plural worlds. Many American ministers were trained at Yale or associated with Yale-trained colleagues. Many Methodists were influenced by and were aware of their fellow Methodist, the Reverend Amos Pettingill, who wrote a very simplified text of astronomy known as A View of the Heavens. The text was prepared to teach average Methodists something about basic astronomy. Now, you have to understand, average Methodists were relatively uneducated people at the time. It made use of scriptural passages such as, quote, "Praise him, all ye stars of light." Each chapter begins with this kind of scriptural basis. And taught, in addition to substantive astronomy, the plurality of worlds, the preexistence of intelligences, the glory of the third heaven, and that Jesus came to this world because it was the most wicked. It cannot be demonstrated, tempting as it might be, that Joseph Smith read Pettingill's primer. It is not amiss, however, to assume that doctrines contained in it were in toto or in part discussed in the Methodist class which Joseph Smith joined in 1828. The book itself was written in 1825. The primer was intended for just such a body. There is also a possibility that Joseph Smith came in contact with such ideas through Emma Hale and her family. Emma was herself a schoolteacher, and her father's house was so often frequented by itinerant Methodist ministers that it was called the preacher's house. These Methodist clerics were probably aware of John Wesley's five-volume work on natural theology, the title of which is almost identical to John Ray's work, and his discussions of the idea of plurality of worlds. Now, Wesley rejected the idea of plurality of worlds, but not so unequivocally that it could not be accepted by Methodists like Pettingill and others. He just said that he didn't think there was a sufficient scientific basis for it and that it was too hard to work into the scriptures. But he goes into great detail on this in various sermons as well as in the text of his natural theological work. They may also have been acquainted with Wesley's treatment of the third heaven as that place closest to God. This is an idea very common in the theology of the day. The appearance of the argument from design and heliocentric astronomy in the Book of Mormon becomes much more intelligible in light of the theologico-scientific environment of frontier America. In a pseudepigraphic work like the Book of Mormon, heliocentrism is not an anachronism. It was only natural for the, quote, keystone of the, quote, restoration of all things to contain the truths of astronomy known to virtually all of the frontier Illuminati. As with infant baptism, Joseph Smith wanted to set the scriptural record right with regard to the earth and the sun when he composed the Book of Mormon. The plurality of worlds theme, so common in America at all intellectual levels, from Yale to itinerant preachers, did not become a feature of Joseph Smith's theology until his 1830 reworking of Genesis, known as the Book of Moses. In this text, Joseph Smith has Enoch declare, "If man could number the particles of the earth, yea, millions of earths like this, it would not be a beginning to the number of thy creations." The Book of Mormon not only adopts the notion of plural worlds, but also identifies this world as the most wicked and therefore the one to which Jesus as a Savior must come. It thus parallels the ideas put forth in Pettingill's text, and which were held by many who accepted the doctrine of plural worlds and one atonement. The Book of Moses does not represent Joseph Smith's most mature thought on the theological application of astronomical principles. His most systematic statement on the subject appears in his final pseudepigraph, the Book of Abraham, which he claimed to translate from papyri beginning in 1835. In the Book of Abraham, Joseph Smith combined the idea of the plurality of worlds with a cosmic doctrine of serial heliocentrism and a belief in the plurality of gods. According to the text, the cosmos consists of a hierarchical series of systems, each governed by a body analogous to the sun. Joseph Smith wrote that God showed Abraham the stars, that they were very great, and that one of them was nearest unto the throne of God, and that there were many great ones which were near unto it. The name of the great one is Kolob, which bears a striking resemblance to the Hebrew word Kokov, which is the word for star. And it says in the text that Kolob is the chief of the Kokavim, which is the head of the stars. "And I have set this one to govern all those which belong to the same order as that upon which thou standest." The idea of a vast series of solar systems and systems of solar systems lent itself to the idea that various systems were made by different gods. In chapter 4 of the Book of Abraham, Joseph Smith taught that even this world was formed by a group of gods. This unique doctrine seems to derive from Joseph Smith's discovery that the Hebrew word Elohim was often applied to God, which was often applied to God, was a plural. Now, I've written on this before. Joseph Smith, when he was about to begin the study of Hebrew in 1835, he was going to have Dr. Peixoto come and teach Hebrew, but Dr. Peixoto couldn't come. But but Joseph's lieutenants had supplied him with various Hebrew lexicons before this time. And from these Hebrew lexicons, Joseph Smith undoubtedly became aware that the word Elohim was a plural of the word Aloha, not to be confused with a Polynesian word. And this, coupled with the fact that many, many ministers at the time, and I found lots of sermons that deal with the Trinity, attempting to prove the Trinity from the plurality of Elohim. This was a commonplace. But what Joseph did, I think, is make an important intellectual leap here in combining plurality of worlds with the plurality of Elohim before he ever had anyone who was competent in Hebrew explain to him that that when it refers to God, it's always used with a singular verb, and how the word happens to develop in the way that it does. It's also used for judges. In Exodus, the Elohim are the judges who will judge the people. So it's a word that's used in various ways in the Hebrew scriptures. But Joseph would have focused on this one thing, and his scientific thinking about plurality of worlds would have helped him conceptualize this. This is about as far as I've been able to get in my understanding of how he developed this notion. The originality of the theology in the Book of Abraham is a striking example of Joseph Smith's continual striving to integrate his current learning with his theology. Just as the Book of Mormon solved the theological dilemmas of his youth, the Book of Abraham served to unify the ideas he considered important in his maturity. Elsewhere, Dr. Louis Zucker and I have discussed in detail the influence of Joseph Smith's study of Hebrew with Professor Satius on the Book of Abraham. And I think that Sunstone is still selling the Satius grammars with Louis Zucker's article as an introduction. I can recommend that to you. But you have to be able to read Hebrew to understand the significance of this text. If you don't read Hebrew, it will never become apparent to you exactly what's going on in the text of Abraham. But because of its importance in showing how Joseph Smith used materials at hand to fashion his religion, I will quickly summarize his application of Hebrew in that work. The facsimiles contain numerous transliterations of Hebrew words like Shemao, Rakiach, Hakokavim, which follow Satius's rules for transliteration. Now, once again, Satius is a Sephardic Jew, and he transliterates words in a Sephardic manner, and you can always tell it. For example, in the Doctrine and Covenants, Baruch El is transliterated in a Sephardic way, even though that section of the Doctrine and Covenants is supposedly before Joseph Smith's study of Hebrew. I mean, it could not have been before his study of Hebrew because he could not have transliterated them. The Baruch El had to have been added afterwards. Do you see? I mean, and no one has seen how you can use this study of Hebrew, perhaps, as a way of determining how these developments occur. The final two chapters of the text of Abraham are free renderings of Genesis 1 and 2 of the Hebrew Bible using the Satius grammar as a dictionary and translation guide. In these respects, the Book of Abraham became the vehicle through which Joseph Smith integrated his Hebrew studies with his other areas of interest. The fact that Joseph Smith chose to attribute the papyri which he purchased to Abraham is significant. This occurred at a time when he and Oliver Cowdery had finished studying the works of Josephus. Oliver, in fact, noted the correspondence between Joseph Smith's description of the contents of the Abrahamic papyri and Josephus's Antiquities of the Jews. Josephus emphasized Abraham's great learning and the fact that he taught the Egyptians astronomy. It was quite natural, therefore, for Joseph Smith to associate Egyptian papyri with Abraham and astronomy. It was further natural for the pseudepigraph so produced to reflect Joseph Smith's concomitant study of Hebrew, which had focused on the text of Genesis. In the Book of Abraham, Joseph Smith wove the astronomical threads of his thought, which began in the Book of Mormon, with the threads which he picked up as he grew in learning and sophistication. With the Book of Abraham, the student of Joseph Smith is no longer dealing with a youth who is reacting to the revivalist environment of the frontier. Joseph Smith, at this point, is a student of traditional sources for the study of religion. You mean Josephus, he's able to cope with the Hebrew scriptures at a certain level. And in the King Follett Discourse, we see him bringing these strands further together. He's an innovator capable of synthesizing ideas from a broader spectrum and thereby truly creating a new variant of Christianity. The Book of Abraham, begun in 1836 and finished in 1842, reveals the mature Joseph Smith and ends the study of his science and theology as a response to frontier revivalism. Now, let me conclude very briefly. Joseph Smith was primarily a religious thinker who synthesized a new religion out of the religious ideas in his frontier environment. Among those ideas was the concept of natural theology, the view that God was revealed in his creation. As with ideas of baptism and manifestations of religion like the falling exercise, Joseph Smith was influenced by natural theology and included the argument by design, heliocentrism, and the plurality of worlds in the sacred literature which he created. This essay has primarily toward natural theology among the Methodists, and Joseph Smith's admitted attraction to Methodism as a possible source of his natural theology. It is probable that Presbyterians, and this is especially true of Presbyterians, let me say that. If you read Presbyterian lectures, they're even more impressive than Methodist lectures if you read Joseph Smith concurrently. Baptists and other religious groups in Joseph Smith's milieu also contributed to his adoption of a natural theological point of view. Although scientific ideas were not central to Joseph Smith's theological concerns, they did help shape his theology, especially his ideas on the plurality of gods. It is my hope that scholars will more fully research the connections which I have so imperfectly suggested between natural theology of frontier revivalism and the development of Joseph Smith's thought. Thank you.
Michael Walton suggests that there are plausible connections between Joseph Smith's ideas and his religious environment, and concludes from this that the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham are pseudepigraphic. Now, much of what Michael says here, he has said either in other places or Mark Thomas has said it, so that most of the paper really isn't new or original entirely. One of the problems that we have to deal with in history is the sources of Joseph Smith's ideas. I think you have two sorts of problems here. If you're talking about his general religious ideas that he expressed over time in his writings, which he admitted were his writings, then you have one problem. If you have it in a text which he said was ancient history, you have another problem. As far as the first problem goes, if there are in Joseph Smith's environment ideas similar to his or even identical to his, and I think there are ideas very similar to his, the important question for the LDS is not how does he get introduced to the idea, but how does he decide which of them is true? Now, on that second point, I don't think any scholar finally knows, and I think Michael recognizes the limitations of scholarship. How do we know how Joseph decides what's true? We can only make inferences. We make inferences on the basis of our own assumptions, whatever they are, religious, historical, or whatever. I don't think we can finally say. Now, when it comes to material within a text that claims to be history, you have a different sort of situation. If LDS scholars don't like what Michael is doing here, I would simply remind them that it's the LDS that have thrown down the gauntlet and challenged everybody to examine and consider. I quote a recent scholar, a defender of the faith, who said that critics must examine the historical, cultural, social elements in the Book of Mormon and show that they cannot represent ancient world origins. That's exactly what Michael's trying to do. We bring it on ourselves if we don't like it. I happen to think it's healthy. But in any case, I think that scholars often bring what they are to the text. This point has been raised by Lou Midgley and Don Sorensen and others. I think in my own experience as I wrote my dissertation, which Michael cites, 1968, I thought I saw a lot of things in the Book of Mormon. I'm reading it again. I find all kinds of different things because I'm different today than I was then. My understanding is different. Historical judgments are tentative. Any history is an interim report based on what our current knowledge and insights are. We can't really be final about these things. Now, One of the strange things about Mormon studies is that we all like to get into it. Whatever our background, preparation, scholarly interests happen to be. LDS scholars go off and study English or languages or a whole host of things and come back and write about Mormon history without adequate background to do what they're trying to do. Now, if you were really going to try to decide whether the Book of Mormon is authentic history, you would have to be an expert in not only the life of Joseph Smith, but his cultural, religious, social background. I would suggest that to do that takes a lifetime in and of itself. You would have to know Hebrew studies in all its aspects, the language, the literature, the history. You would have to know Egyptian language, culture. How do you do all that? How do you master all the things that it takes to make those sorts of judgments? Well, the answer is you can't. So you have to depend on secondary sources and so on. Any kind of conclusions that you draw are tentative, and they're based on who you are and what your own assumptions about life and religion and so on are. So if we think what we have here is finality, I think that's an arrogance. I appreciate Michael recognizing that it's tentative, and I wish that some LDS scholars did. Now, a recent text by Mormon scholars defending the faith or originating out of BYU has one scholar who is a lawyer with training in classical languages studying chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, which has to do with the Hebrew language. He claims no expertise, and yet he makes the argument. An English professor without training in geography examines Lehi's trip to the Red Sea and decides that it is verifiable, and so on and so on. The temptation is overwhelming, you see, because our involvement is so great. Hugh Nibley long ago said Mormons aren't adequately trained to do what they try to do. I think that's still true. I think that if LDS scholars want non-Mormons to take them seriously, that they must limit the area they talk about and increase their expertise a great deal. The whole business about the two new letters that everybody's excited about showing Joseph's involvement in gold digging illustrates perhaps the point. There were certainly scholars who were pretty much convinced before these two letters showed up that Joseph was involved in it heavily. There was a lot of evidence. But again, we get some people who are not well prepared in American things, writing in the field and making their arguments, sometimes with their conclusions already made before they start. If you've got your answers already, you don't need to make the inquiry. So my plea is for open-mindedness. I really think, as far as LDS are concerned, that the most dangerous thing is the panic. When something new shows up, the fear. This can stop thinking and stop inquiry. We need to stay open-minded and loose.
Well, thank you all for coming, and the session is adjourned.
Oh, that's why we should have
It's just that every other session has gone over time. We've never had time. Let's have questions for both of them or either of them.
And bearing in mind, Marvin is much more expert in this area of American studies than I am, so. But I have a certain kind of technical knowledge about Hebrew. No questions, right? Well, sir.
I'm trying to get the question together because I find your presentation this morning very interesting, very useful for me in terms of perception of the historical insight that may come, or the human insight that may come from the study of history, study of languages, whatever. I have argued the position of accepting the fact that in terms of any kind of witness of faith, that finally is a religious experience from God or whatever source. And it seems to me that what you're saying here is... let me ask the question. Do you think that there is any way that through your studies that you can any way verify...
I don't believe there's such a thing as historical truth. I can say it is a factual statement that in the Book of Abraham we have Sephardic transliterations. You see, now that is a factual statement, but how I interpret that statement is truly dependent upon what I've been thinking about, 3 hours before. And that's why I say I approach this from a secular point of view. I approach the text of the Book of Abraham or the Book of Mormon exactly the same way that I would approach the biblical text or the Decretals of Gresham or any other text. And I see personally at this moment no reason to go back to intertestamental writings or anything like that to analyze the Book of Mormon. I feel it's a book that comes forth at a given moment in time, and let me analyze it in terms of that time. That's simply what I'm saying, and see what we can make of it from that perspective. But I don't believe it.
Mr. Wall, maybe this is a little bit along the same line. How do you respond to Dr. Hill's point that the important question is not so much how Joseph Smith gets introduced to an idea or exposed to an idea, but how he decides which ones are true, or to use your terms, how he decides how to synthesize what he's been exposed to.
Has always been, as a historian of science, when I read about Newton, study Newton, I'm not quite sure why Newton was able to adduce the inverse square law and Huygens wasn't. You see, Huygens knew it was some kind of inverse proportional. But Newton hits it. Is it because he had the tool of the calculus, which he had developed? I don't know. Why somebody sees one thing and not another is very difficult to say. But if you look at something like the Book of Abraham, you begin to see that a way in which Joseph is always trying to make his universe coherent, as are we all, as a matter of fact. He seems to have certain predilections, that begin very early on. I can't tell you why he has those predilections, but I can tell you that certain themes are developed. It's like a symphony. You have the statement of the theme, and then it gets more developed as you go through. Why he's doing that, I have the vaguest idea.
Well, Newton never claimed that God verified his conclusions.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I would say that Newton was a very theological person who believed. I mean, absolute time and space were theological concepts to Newton. You see, and Kepler believed that God revealed to him in a vision before a class the order of the universe, and that's why he spent 6.5 years working on the orbit of Mars. You can't explain why some idiot will stand there and draw little circles until he gets one, a particular, the odd ellipse that explains that, unless he's doing it out of some religious faith. I don't know. I wouldn't say that. I'd say they're very similar kinds of things. We all have what we think is important.
Well, I guess I take it Dr. Hill's point is that a historian cannot answer, or that history can't answer that question.
Of course. How could it?
Okay.
What we would call scientific history which is a history where we take facts and we try and put them into a theoretical framework. And what you have to do is come along and say, has the historian accounted for all the facts that are relevant in this theory? If he doesn't, then we have to change and alter the theory. It's very much like science, only we can't go back and, you know, dissect Joseph Smith. So that's what we're doing. We're neither faith promoting nor faith destroying. We're just trying to come to an understanding. And we, you know, I mean, you can't, whether God appeared to Joseph Smith or Gabriel to Muhammad, or, I mean, these are, we can just talk about them believing that they saw these kinds of things. It's certainly not part of our job, thank goodness. Any other questions?
I get the feeling that there seems to be a resurgence in studies of early Mormonism and Joseph Smith, both among LDS scholars and non-LDS scholars. Is this true? I mean, is there really an exciting breakthrough starting to occur as far as the number and the effort being put forth and
Smith? That's been going on for 20 years. But still...